Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Long before September 11th, George Bush spelled out his view of America's place in the world. Lonely at the top. Here's candidate Bush during campaign 2000.
Our nation is stands alone right now in the world in terms of power, and that's why we've got to be humble and yet project strength in a way that promotes freedom. So I don't think that'll look at us in any way other than what we are. We're a freedom-loving nation, and if we're an arrogant nation, they'll view us that way. But if we're a humble nation, they'll respect us.
After September 11th, humility seemed less of an option. It was time to project strength. As President Bush prepares to persuade his allies and U.S. citizens that a massive show of force is now needed in Iraq, he is hewing closely to his newly published national security strategy. Every president has to produce one, but seldom do they make such a statement. The White House document powerfully shifts U.S. foreign policy from a post-Cold War model to a new world, where failed states and terrorists pose the latest, greatest threat. On this new stage, the key to peace and security is a U.S. military force that is superior to all and ready to strike whenever and wherever needed. Now, Connection listeners, everyone agrees that the U.S. is the only superpower. The question is, how should the only superpower behave? Should U.S. military might lead foreign policy, or in a world where disparities in strength and power are already so marked, how much should humility come into it? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guests this hour are Joseph Nye. He is Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and author of The Paradox of American Power. And joining us from a studio in Washington, Tom Donnelly, a fellow with Project for a New American Century. It's a policy think tank in Washington, D.C. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Glad to be with you.
Tom, let me start with you. Strip away all that you consider extraneous in the 30 pages of the strategy and point me to what you consider to be the nub of this new document. What will it be remembered for?
Well, I don't want to prevaricate from the start, but I think there are two nubs. One, you hit very well in your intro, and that is the recognition the United States has certain responsibilities as such an overwhelming power in the world. The second is a clearer recognition of the threat posed by proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the ease with which really bad guys in the world are likely to be able to obtain those, in fact have obtained those weapons now. So there's a new urgency about protecting ourselves against those.
So do you see it as a document, then, which simply reacts to circumstances that changed after September 11th, or something that is slightly grander, something that will, in fact, turn this ship in a direction that it hasn't been before?
Well, I do see it as consistent with really the broad thread of American foreign policy going back even before we were a nation, and that is making the world safe for liberty, not to be too pompous about it. But it is also, I think, a clearer recognition of where we stand in the world after the Cold War, what is dangerous to us and what is no longer danger to us as well.
Joe Nye, your headline for the National Security Strategy, what strikes you?
Well, it's very much a post 9/11 document. Presidents have to produce a strategy like this, desired by the Congress. The last one that Clinton did was in 99. It was at the time of the Asian financial crisis, bore a lot of the marks of the Asian financial crisis. This one clearly bears a lot of the marks of after 9/11. So I think it when it talks about preemption, focusing on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, it is an effort to explain how we're going to cope with these new realities.
And with apologies to the president, let's be clear, it's not written for the boys in Lubbock. It's written for the rest of the world to see what Washington's trying to project at present, right?
Right. It's an effort to pull together various statements that the president has made over time. Indeed, the subsections of it usually start with a quote from a Bush speech sometime during the past year, and to try to put them in a more coherent framework or pattern.
Now, Tom Donnelly, you've been quoted as saying that the fascination or the concentration on the word preemptive is a little bit of a red herring in this one. Can you explain that for me?
Well, because the principle involved that you need not suffer an attack before it's lawfully and strategically imperative to respond is a principle that has a centuries-long tradition sort of in the law of war, if you will.
And you don't think it's been shifted up on the policy priority list here?
Well, that is the difference. It's a timeless principle, as it were, applied under quite different circumstances. What I do object to is the idea that this is a new invention, historically speaking, when in fact it's the application of, a timeless principle, just a recognition that circumstances have changed.
And looking back over the couple of years of this administration, Joe, it's notable also because it shows us how much this administration itself has changed from their initial expression of not being particularly interested in always being a part of everything international to now being involved in everything international.
Well, it's true that the administration came into office arguing that it would cut back on some of the peacekeeping operations, get away from nation building and so forth. And that's what I mean that 9/11 changed a lot. It changed the framework of the administration's perception of the world, as it did for many people in the country as a whole. But if I could go back to this point about preemption, Tom's right, it's not new, but it all depends on how it's used. After all, the Japanese preempted at Pearl Harbor. Israel preempted in the 67 war. The traditional justification of preemption is if you're about to be hit, you hit first. But the key is, are you about to be hit? And if you say, well, in a couple of years, somebody might hurt me, so I'll go to war with them now, that's not preemption. That's called preventive war. And that has long been distinguished from preemption. And in the Bush Doctrine, there is a blurring of that as to whether, for example, we're really talking about preemption or prevention. And a lot of this is okay at the level of the words that are used. The question is, how will the words be implemented? If, for example, you tried to use the preemption doctrine to go into Iraq to change the regime, that's preventive war. That's not preemption. If you see Saddam about to launch a terrorist attack or develop a nuclear weapon, and then you strike, that's preemption. But we're not, we won't know whether they mean prevention or preemption until we see how they apply the words they've used.
The blurring in the strategy is consistent with the blurring in the policy directed towards Iraq at this moment, then.
That's right. I mean, at first we were heard from the administration that the goal was regime change. Then it became disarmament, and now there's a great deal of to and fro about which of these is the dominant objective. If it's a case of striking just before you're about to be struck, then Tom's right. There's good precedent for that, and it's justifiable. If it's sort of looking ahead and striking because you may be struck or you may be endangered sometime in the future, let's say a couple of years, then that's long been discouraged by the U.N. Charter and by international law.
I want both of you to help me with...
Yeah,
go ahead, Tom.
Before we leave that point, I think it's actually, unfortunately, Joe who's doing the blurring. I think, look, we do have to understand that the quality of weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons, in this kind of a case... perhaps that does sort of naturally blur the long-time distinction. A lot of this has to do with the consequences of suffering a first strike in the employment of these weapons. The presumption that underlies the question of imminence in the past has a lot to do with what the consequences of such an attack would be. And that's why waiting until the very last minute, when, of course, you can never perfectly be sure if somebody's actually developed a weapon of mass destruction, and particularly a nuclear weapon, you know, you don't have the luxury of sort of suffering the first blow before responding. So I think what the president is arguing is that the confluence of a high likelihood of the employment of these weapons, plus the catastrophic consequences that would be involved. Again, I may have misspoke in saying that Joe's the one doing the blurring, but perhaps it's inevitable under those circumstances that maintaining a black and white distinction between preventative war and preempting a potential strike involving weapons of mass destruction is no longer tenable.
But we can agree that the consequences are different, but also notice that Tony Blair said that Iraq getting a nuclear weapon is 2 to 4 years or more away. President Bush himself said it's more than a year away. I've written, indeed, in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying that I think the use of force to prevent Saddam getting a nuclear weapon is justified, but there's a big difference between doing something because it's preempting, meaning within a reasonable close time frame, and when you're talking about 2 to 4 years, that's preventive.
I know we're going to be talking about Iraq more in the course of this conversation, but it's not simply the question of nuclear weapons. We do know that the Iraqi regime does have possession of biological weapons and chemical weapons, and not only that, has the capability to manufacture more. So it isn't a question of whether or not Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction. We already know that to be the case. I would also note in passing that in the process of concluding the Gulf War, and when inspectors went in and when our forces went in, after the Gulf War, we discovered that Iraqi progress on nuclear weapons was much more advanced than we thought it was.
I do want to talk a little bit further about specifically this point. I also want to move the conversation to a kind of a broader view of exactly what the message the United States is sending when it talks about it being and expecting to be and hoping to be the military power unchallenged in the world. But just before we move to that, a final word on preemption, Joe Nye, and that is, what's the message to the other countries that are looking at this and wondering how it affects their policy?
Well, the danger of blurring the distinction between preemption and prevention, which is a long-standing distinction broadly accepted, is it opens the door for others to do the same thing. So the question of, do the Indians then feel that they can move against Pakistan? Do the Russians feel they can move against Georgia? What kind of a world do we want to live in? Better to keep this distinction. And there are times, indeed, when we should preempt. But preemption ought to be preemption, not blurring it into prevention.
All right, Connection listeners, we're talking about the national security strategy laid out just 10 days ago by President Bush that emphasizes, perhaps more in more clear language than has been seen before, the importance of maintaining the most powerful military in the world. And what that says to nations abroad and what it means as the United States prepares for a very busy week on the issue of what's going to happen with a resolution against Iraq. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Year 1740, and a man called James Thompson sits down and pens the words to Rule Britannia. Verse 2. The nations not so blessed as thee must in their turns to tyrants fall, while thou shalt flourish great and free, the dread and envy of them all. When we talk about the national security strategy and a nation asserting in real time that the military will remain unchallenged anywhere in the world. We're talking in many ways about an assertion of empire. And with me on the program today, Tom Donnelly, fellow with the Project for a New American Century, and Joe Nye, dean of Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. It is that larger question of what's the broad statement, what's being chiseled in stone with this one. Tom Donnelly, it seems like something fairly dramatic.
Well, it certainly is that. It is an assertion of global American both power and responsibility.
But saying to every other nation that you will never have a military as strong as ours, and in fact our policy will see to it that that doesn't happen?
Well, look, it actually is an attainable goal and worth thinking about.
Disraeli probably thought
as long
the same
as it,
thing, you know?
Well, on the other hand, because we are an empire of liberty, to use Thomas Jefferson's phrase, the goal is perhaps attainable and even perhaps more importantly, worth striving to achieve. It's just simply the fact that American power is qualitatively different from even British power. This is not a threat to our fellow democracies throughout the world. In fact, it's the promise of the extension of a benefit. And surely...
Isn't that what the Romans said when they spread the Roman Empire, though, that we're not actually here to threaten you, we're here to make your life better, Joe Nye?
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think the facts of American power are, as Tom says, and indeed a decade ago I wrote a book saying that the United States would be the dominant power of the 21st century. The great conventional wisdom of the time was the U.S. was in decline. People seem to forget that. The new conventional wisdom is that we're on top and it'll be there forever. And my new book basically says we're going to be there for decades, but you know what? Over time, our relative power is going to erode. We should use this period to develop a framework which is helpful for our interests and values at a time later in the century when we won't be quite as powerful as we are now. And that requires us to develop something I call soft power, which is your attractiveness. Hard power is your ability to coerce others, that you're using your military or economic might. We've got that. We're going to have it. We're going to stay number one in that dimension for the next couple of decades. Soft power is your ability to attract others. It grows out of your culture, your political ideals, and the policies.
But that's there too, isn't it?
It is there. The danger is we squander it if we act arrogantly. And what I see as a real worry is not that we're going to be so powerful, but we've got to learn not to rub other people's noses in it. We have to learn to attract them, not just coerce them. And I think if you look at Bush's document, it's pretty good in many ways in saying, for example, we'll help poor people to develop. We will help counter HIV/AIDS in Africa. There are many things where we do make ourselves attractive by aligning ourselves with the aspirations of other peoples. But there's also that little bit near the end where it says nobody can come near us militarily, and there's a little touch of arrogance there that may get us into trouble.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to start in Buffalo, New York. Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Yes, hello. How are you, gentlemen?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, well, I think the comment about our assertion of our empire is a little disingenuous. I think there's a danger to the American people in being too civilized. It might sound harsh to say that, but for the 20th and 21st century, like the Romans, we could have really conquered the world if we used our nuclear and military might. I think we are now the most perfect, benign superpower the world could have. I wouldn't want any other country to have our power. We need to protect ourselves. We were attacked, and asserting our protection, I think, is our duty. And the concept of preemption...
Let's just stick with that, if I can, Robert, because the idea of being the biggest, meanest, toughest, wealthiest kid on the block, does that kid actually have to say, I'm the biggest, toughest, wealthiest kid on the block, or does everybody just know it?
Well, if somebody, first of all, I don't appreciate the word mean, using it against the United States. If someone attacks you, you don't have to tell them you're mean or you're whatever. You protect yourself. We were attacked. it's as simple as that. I think putting the label of mean on the United States is really kind of seditious.
Let's not get hung up on that. It's just
you used a word.
Fair enough. No, and I'm withdrawing it for the purposes of the conversation. What I'm saying is, if it's a fact, does it need to be asserted, put down on a piece of paper?
Put down a piece of paper? I don't understand what you mean.
What we're talking about is the national security strategy that Bush has published, saying that this country is the strongest and will remain the strongest. I'm asking you whether or not putting it down on paper changes it in any way.
I don't see it makes any difference on paper or not. Everybody knows that we're here to protect ourselves, whether you write it on paper. Paper is worth the paper it's written on. It's our actions that speak. If we're attacked, we protect ourselves. Whether it's on paper or not, it makes no difference, does it?
Tom Donnelly, does it make a difference?
Yeah, actually, I think it does. I agree with sort of many of the sentiments that the caller expresses. But there are a number of benefits that come from stating the truth in a plain way. First of all, because we enjoy a really historic opportunity to preserve the democratic peace that we now enjoy, it is really worth recognizing and stating for all to see our commitment to preserving that. Secondly, Joe made an important point about the other dimensions of American power, and I would say that a lot of the opposition that we run into around the world is because we do enjoy such incredible cultural and economic and power to attract people to our ideals. That in many ways is what's most threatening, say, to a guy like Osama bin Laden. It's not simply that we're operating in the Persian Gulf, but many of the radical Islamists speak of America as the great Satan because it's the great seducer. So, and finally, it's especially important for the government and the president to tell the other departments of the executive branch sort of what the purpose of their existence is, especially in the Department of Defense, which is really one agency that takes a huge directive from this national security strategy. So it is important to sort of get our bureaucratic ducks in a row and to make sure that we're producing the right kind of government structures, the diplomatic especially, and military structures that will achieve the goals that the president has laid out.
But Joe, in your book, The Paradox of American Power, you make the point that, just as Tom is saying, that money has to go to State Department. Money has to go in foreign aid. That, if you're going to push a doctrine that is as bracingly blunt, I think The Economist called it that, that you actually have to then pony up in those areas of soft power. What's your sense? Is that going to happen?
Well, if you look at the budget that we have and you lump together State Department, AID, Voice of America, everything other than defense, we spend 17 times more on defense than we do on the various instruments of soft power. Hard and soft power are not opposed. They're complementary to each other. But we could do a lot better balance in the way we approach it. It's a little bit like learning to walk on two legs rather than just hop along on one.
There's that other feature too, Tom, and in the document where the Bush administration is calling on all allies to put more money into their own defense budgets. I know this has been something that diplomats abroad have been talking about increasingly lately. Is it your sense that this is consistent with the will remain supreme, but you've got to at least keep pace?
No, look, it's a big world. We've got a huge challenge in front of us, and we need all the help that we can get. I'm just back from a week in Germany and elsewhere in Europe, and especially after the contentious German election and the unfortunate name-calling that precipitated, it has obscured the fact that Germany, the wealthiest, largest power country in Europe, really unable to make a significant military contribution to any of these missions that might flow from the Bush doctrine. And that's tremendously unfortunate. I would not give the administration high marks for courting its allies or our allies before this. And there's a lot of good rhetoric in the document about the need to do so. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we really do need to have especially our large, wealthy Democratic allies lending a hand and lending a significant hand, sharing the risks to life and limb as well as the economic risks of trying to broaden the Democratic peace.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Robert, thanks for your call to Madison, Wisconsin now, and Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I would like to really start arguing with your people over an empire of liberty, an empire of liberty indeed. If you go back to, and your guest began speaking about colonial days, we find that the colonial establishment and then the national establishment was based on the genocide implicit in the conquering of and disappearance of hundreds of Native nations. And it's a continuum, and it continues, and it gets worse and worse and worse. In this century, in the last century, we saw the American power undermine freedom and democracy and liberty all over the world, from the micro, the ridiculous strongest country in the world invading Grenada, to subterfuges around Congo Zaire and Iran and Guatemala, who are establishing democracy in Chile and Panama. And then we need to talk about where terrorism comes from. And we never talk about terrorism coming from a school in Georgia and the State Department and the military and the terror wrought on the Afghani people by the Taliban supported by us, created by the Pakistanis and the Americans, the terrorism in Yugoslavia.
Okay, let me just on and on.
And yeah. To talk about an empire of liberty is just ahistorical and silly.
All right, Jeff from Madison, Wisconsin is taking issue with the very notion that there can be any kind of national security strategy that promotes peace and liberty abroad. He's saying that it's all about conquering, always has been, always will be. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Tom Donnelly, do you want to speak back to Jeff here?
Not in every detail, because I don't think we have quite that much time.
You're right.
Look, I would obviously argue the contrary point of view. But to try to reach some common understanding, I would suggest that the difficulty in this world is that there's always a tension between principle and power. What the founders of this country tried to do and have actually succeeded rather well in doing, I would say, was employing power in the pursuit of our principles of liberty. So we are obligated to act practically in the world, and that sometimes makes us some very strange bedfellows. But, for example, to get in bed with Stalin and for the purpose of defeating Nazi Germany, I think is a defensible practice. And I would not defend every decision made by the United States government in 230 years or so, but on balance, I think one of the earlier callers suggested that compared to any other practical or actual alternative, the American employment of power in the world has been relatively benign.
Joe Nye?
Yes, I think I think it's a mistake to see the United States as an empire, a mistake for us to try to become one. But if there's going to be one power with more than others, I think the Americans have done more to promote freedom than, let's say, if the Soviets had won the Cold War. I think the important thing about this document, though, that we're discussing today, is it has a Wilsonian flavor to it about expanding human dignity and freedom, and that's very interesting. Those are positive things. The key question is how they're going to be implemented.
Tom, do you read the Wilsonian flavor in the lines?
Yeah, except I don't think that impulse is really strictly a Wilsonian impulse. This is a very broad and consistent theme throughout the history of our country. It's lately become described as Wilsonian, but the commitment to individual liberty, life liberty in the pursuit of happiness, is our founding principles.
But the multilateral side of it is, I would argue, not being seen abroad the way it's being seen in this country, that when Bush speaks in a national security strategy, Joe, about wanting to project on all these other fronts, people just tick off. Kyoto, biological convention, landmines, international criminal court. Where's the United States on all these? That the evidence, so the argument goes, and you know it well, is that the proof's not there.
Well, the problem is that the president came into office with this very nice statement about if we're a humble nation, they'll respect us, and if we're an arrogant nation, they won't. Then he turned to a quite unilateralist policy, along the lines you just discussed. Then after September 11th, he turned back toward building coalitions to defeat terrorism. Then after the victory in Afghanistan in December, they swung back more toward unilateralism, for example, saying that the Geneva Protocols didn't cover prisoners, something they had to back away from. And you see a tug of war inside the administration between those who say we're big enough and tough enough, just don't pay attention to others, and those who say we really do need to pay more respect for the views of others. And that tug of war is crucial, because if the first strand wins, essentially we will create the mode of arrogance that the president was warning against, and which will undercut our soft power. If the second strand wins, which is often associated with Colin Powell and the State Department, I think we're more likely to preserve our power and to be more effective.
Tom, do you see it as a tug of war the way Joe's describing it?
No, not frankly, not really. This has been the sort of Manichaean view of the Bush administration that I think at this point is not really very helpful. And I'm not going to defend the administration's ham-handedness in treating with our allies. However, at the end of the day, what is really important is what we do more than how we do it. And that will not prevent us from having allies and a coalition if we go to war in Iraq. And it will not prevent us from acting multilaterally in a variety of other circumstances. The things like the International Criminal Court are in fact meant to hamper our role as the world's guarantor of everyone else's
Tom,
security.
I have to stop you. We're stepping away for a break. We'll pick this up when we come back. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Joseph Nye, Dean of Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and author of The Paradox of American Power, Why the World's Only Superpower Can't Go It Alone. Joining us from our Washington studio, Tom Donnelly, fellow at the Project for a New American Century. And what we're talking about this hour, and particularly in context of this week, when the UN becomes seized with a resolution that could either reach some consensus or not on weapons inspections in Iraq, when the U.S. Congress begins debate on the president's wish for the power to attack Iraq should he deem it necessary, at the very moment when the weapons inspectors are checking their kit and making their travel plans. It's being done under or on a foundation that the Bush administration laid out about 10 days ago, the National Security Strategy, which emphasizes the need in Bush's mind for unparalleled military strength, the necessity of being able to make a preemptive strike when and where necessary, though not particularly new, a little bit more emphasis on it in this document, and how you see America projecting itself abroad with the language that's in the Bush Doctrine. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. First to Burlington, Vermont, and Joe's on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. Let's see, I've got a point and then a question. The point has to do with something your speakers spoke to a little bit earlier. And it's not new, but I think it represents a popular view. They were talking about the consequences of a strike against us with a weapon of mass destruction. And I'm only 28, but I've lived with that even in my lifetime to some extent. And large populations of the world live with that right now. And my concern, and I think many people share this, is that the consequences are of our actions in terms of retaliation could be much greater. And 9/11 very much proved that we cannot defend against certain terrorist actions without stripping our civil liberties.
So are you saying that the idea of preemption is in fact more dangerous?
To a certain extent, I think it puts us in the position of possibly continuing that sort of these sort of preemptive actions, as terrorists as their cells, shift from, let's say they've shifted to Afghanistan and then we think they're in Iraq and they shift to somewhere else, then we have to continue our preemptive.
I guess what I'm saying, Joe, is what would be the alternative or the question that you have about that?
My question, that was just a point I wanted to make, that I think it is more dangerous to us to do that, to risk the retaliation, and that we can't defend against that. I had a question about what your speakers had to say about George Bush looking for usable nukes, usable weapons of mass destruction on our end, what they know about that sort of thing.
Can I start, though, with the point that sure. you've made, Joe?
Yeah, on your first point, I think it's important to distinguish between other countries or states and terrorists. Countries are deterrable. They have something to lose. There's a return address. Terrorists are very hard to deter. There's no return address. I think preemption against a terrorist who's about to strike you indeed is justified, indeed is necessary. Very often with a country, as we saw during the Cold War, you can deter them. After all, Stalin was a pretty nasty fellow, but was deterred. But on the question of usable nukes, there has been, this is not mentioned in the new security doctrine. There was a Defense Department paper looking at this question that was in the press, let's say 6 months or so ago. But as far as I understand it, that's not official policy.
Joe, thanks for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to Boston now, and Nadine's on the line. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had a couple of points about how the world views the U.S., and one of the points was, how the U.S. is the most powerful nation in the world, and with power should come greater responsibility. I think the danger right now is that the U.S. has to be seen to be cautious about using its power. Otherwise, it is going to be viewed as an empire if it's not seen to be acting more responsibly with the increase in the power and being the single most powerful nation in the world.
I'm thinking, though, Nadini, of a piece that I read not too long ago where the United States, in being overly cautious about the exercise of its power and sending its Marines sort of rushing out of danger zones in places like Yemen, is exactly what some people say led to the attack on September 11th, that there was abroad this sense that the United States would always be cautious in its response, opening the way up for terrorists.
Right, but the way around it is not to go and attack a country, as a preventative measure rather than, a preemptive measure, the distinction that the speakers were making earlier.
All right. I'm going to ask Tom in on this. Tom.
Yeah. If we listen to Osama bin Laden's rhetoric, it was his belief that at the end the United States was weak-willed that led him to try to drive us out of the Middle East and led to the terrorist attacks on last September 11th, that led to previous terror attacks on our servicemen in the Middle East. It's the prospect of victory that animates our enemies.
Right. I think the U.S. had a great deal of sympathy in the world in that attack against Afghanistan, against the terrorists, but it's a different view this time around.
Why?
Well, if I may, the question is whether how the rest of the world will view us if we are not able to protect them against the likes of Saddam Hussein and other similar sorts of regimes in the world. The people in many parts of the world who share our democratic aspirations run a heck of a lot more risk on a daily basis than we do. It's very dangerous to have beliefs in liberty and individual rights in many and the limitation of state power in many parts of the world. And I think that it's incumbent on us as the wellspring of those ideas and the possessor of such tremendous power to try to help out those folks wherever we can and to protect our friends.
Nadini, thanks for your call. I'm going to move on to Newport, Rhode Island. Christopher's been waiting on the line. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Go ahead.
I don't have any speech to make. I just have a two-part question. It seems to me that one of the predicates of this new Bush policy is that the U.S. and the U.S. alone has an adequate moral compass in matters military. I wonder if the two gentlemen agree that that is a predicate and whether they agree with the substance of it.
I'm happy to go first.
Go ahead, Tom.
And say simply yes. In warfare, it is the ends only that justify the means in many ways, to be a little bit simplistic. The use of military power for the purpose of stabilizing, liberalizing, democratizing the world really is one of the few justifications that one can reasonably offer. This is not a defense of every practice of this administration or the American government through history. Again, simply to assert that it is our hope to bring liberty and safety to people is the only justification for going to war.
And Joe, linking that moral compass with the national security interests of the nation, I mean, in a way, that's the most fascinating nexus of the document itself, that it is in the United States' interest to project that sort of human dignity abroad.
Right, but there's a danger of using force to accomplish human dignity and freedom all over the world. It makes you the world's policeman, which quickly makes you look like an imperial power.
Unless you can pretend you're the reluctant policeman.
Well,
and project
but
that.
Even then, you're going to probably need a posse. And one of the interesting questions is whether you're going to have the support of others. For example, if we wind up going into Iraq, it'll make all the difference in the world whether we do it multilaterally or unilaterally. If we do it unilaterally, we will be regarded as essentially falling into bin Laden's trap of the enemy of Arabs and Islam. If we do it multilaterally with the UN, then we might have that broader justification.
Well, what about what's likely to be the midway point? What if it's just the United States and Britain and perhaps one or two other nations? Does that at least make a difference?
Makes some difference, but I think the extent to which you've done it through a broader framework with a larger posse, you're going to have more legitimacy. And the danger is if you do it unilaterally or with just one or two, such as Britain, you're going to breed the next generation of terrorists. So I think it's very important to actually work with others when we develop this moral compass. It's what the founders said in the Declaration of Independence, decent respect for the opinions of mankind.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Tom, I'm interested in just taking this another step further with you in terms of the importance of the United States working with partners under any set of circumstances, at least as far as it's seen from abroad.
Well, that's two separate questions, and I think it's worth...
Yeah, separate them for me. That's
yeah, look, how it's seen from abroad is an important issue. There's no doubt about it. It is, however, and must be a secondary issue. I think particularly of Gary Cooper in High Noon, which is probably a little bit unfair, but I'm going to use the analogy anyway. The morality of that character's actions was not determined, in fact, only thrown into stark relief by his inability to generate a posse, so to speak. All things being equal, we would much rather have a posse along with us. I think it would be just bad policy over the long run if we were to not neglect the groundwork that has to be done in order to get others to employ power for democratic purposes. But at the end of the day, it's not the process, but it is the purpose that matters. And in those cases where we cannot, despite our best efforts, generate allied support, then we must be willing to act in our interests and in our and to preserve our principles alone if necessary. In fact, that is the way to create a posse. I don't like to say all that much about the Clinton administration.
Tom, I you know, the argument that it's only the purpose, not the process, that matters strikes me as a bit odd. Most people, when they look at going to war, judge it not just in terms of your motives, which is your purpose, but also your means and the consequences. For example, if I'm driving your daughter home late one night after a dance to try to get her home early to get home for the SAT so she's well rested for them, and I drive too fast and go off the road and she's killed, my motives were pure, the consequences were terrible, and my means were inappropriate. You got to look at all three of these, motives, means, and consequences. And I think the process matters tremendously as to whether we're successful in what we're trying to do in the world.
I'm not sure that I'm objecting to that analysis, but they don't. Each one of those three elements doesn't have equal weight. You can have a perfect process, a perfectly consultative process. You can employ appropriate military and other diplomatic means to achieve what you want. But if there's not, again, if it's not for a just cause, then it cannot be a just war.
Yeah, I agree. You need just cause. You also need proportionate means and probability of good consequences. You need all three.
And that's where we're going to have to end it because we're out of time. I want to thank both of you for being with me on this hour. Tom Donnelly, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Tom's a fellow with the Project for a New American Century. And Joseph Nye, thanks for your time.
Nice to be with you.
Joe Nye, Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, author of The Paradox of American Power. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation. You can find us on our forum page at www.theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Meredith Levinson and Carter Holleran. Graham Smith is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.